Amy Hall, and I'm here with Greg Kokel, and we are here to answer your questions on the hashtag STRAsk podcast.
You sound like you can't wait to jump in, Amy. And folks don't know, it's actually a little after 8 in the morning, which is early for me, especially if I'm up late reading. And here's Amy, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Hi!
Well, I'm ready to hear whatever wisdom you have for me, Greg, and for all our listeners.
Oh, well, that's really
listeners.
Sweet. What
okay.
means wisdom? All right, got it.
All right, so let's start with a question from Umaru Jonathan. What sort of faith did Abraham exercise when God called him? Would this be called blind faith?
Well, usually when people use the phrase blind faith, they mean that you believe without reason, without justification. You look at any of the definitions that the currently popular atheists use. There's an old quote from Mark Twain that describes faith as, and he was a very, very hostile to Christian religion. He said, "Believing what you know ain't so." So he put it. But many of the others, whether it's Sam Harris or Chris Hitchens or Richard Dawkins or Peter Boghossian, who we've talked quite a bit about, they all have the same idea. Thinking you know something you don't know, and you don't know it because you have no reason to know it. And so their blind faith is believing something with no reason, or sometimes in the teeth of the good reasons to the contrary, which is a complete distortion of biblical faith, though I admit this is what I think a lot of people do embrace. Although I would say for those Christians who do embrace that, I think their understanding is mistaken, but I don't think that their act of faith is unsound. I mean, we all know there is a work of the Holy Spirit that brings conviction to us, and philosophers have discussed how they think that conviction itself is adequate grounding. I'm trying to remember. I have to think of the chipmunk get his name, Alvin Plantinga. Alvin! Yeah, Alvin Plantinga, you know, has developed this idea a lot. in any event, in Abraham's case, he was called by a supernatural act of God. God talked to him. And in fact, almost every single occasion we see in scriptures of a communication between God and some special in particular person, I'm speaking here now of the Hebrew scriptures, it's a conversation. And we know it's a conversation because it's related as that. And in some cases, other people are aware of what is going on because they can hear the conversation. This happened with Moses and during the Exodus, and the people got scared. They said, "Go over there. You want to talk to God? Go over there, because he scares us." You know, we hear that conversation. So I'm saying this to underscore the point that the way people talk about God talking to them now is nothing, bears no resemblance of any sort to the biblical occasions where this happens, okay? And people say, "Well, God could speak to me just like he did to the people of old." And I said, "Well, he can do that. There's no question in my mind. But what you've just described, your little nudge or feeling or whatever, bears no resemblance to what happened." So in Abraham's case, you have conversations. And I take it that way because that's the way it's related in the text. And in some cases, by the way, when God has a conversation with Abraham, I'm just reading through the book of Genesis right now. I'm just at, you know, where Joseph is sold to Potiphar. There are appearances of God appears in human form, you know. So this to underscore the supernatural act of clear communication that is involved. Now, when you have a supernatural act of clear communication, that isn't a leap of faith. That isn't blind faith the way blind faith is characterized. That is a profound, moving, experience that somebody is having with the true God that grounds their understanding of what God is saying and grounds their conviction that it's legitimate. And by the way, these things don't catch – if you notice when you read these, they don't catch these people by surprise in the sense that what could that be? I don't believe in those kinds of things. I don't live in a world where these things happen. You know, they are, you know, here I am, Lord, you know, kind of thing. Now, that isn't to say that these happened frequently, because they don't seem to have happened frequently. This, it's just to say that are completely and utterly consistent with their worldview. And I think this is, I've been reading through Mike Heiser's book, H-E-I-S-E-R, The Unseen Realm. And I think it's exceptional in kind of reinforcing this notion that we can't read the Old Testament, ancient scripture with modern eyes. These are people who trafficked in the supernatural. It was very real to them. Even if they didn't experience it a lot. Like, it's like, look, you could have a person who's completely unrelated to science, but they believe when they encounter it, what's the authority of science, so to speak. I don't think science has any authority personally, but I think that's the wrong way to talk about it. Science believes some things that are well justified, or it delivers some and other things that are not. The so-called authority is simply based in the rationale or the justification. But in any event, I digress once again. They found themselves in a world that was alive with unseen realities, and even though they didn't encounter them very much, when they did encounter them, it made perfect sense to them in their world. It wasn't in the sense that we think of it. It wasn't bizarre or unusual. Mm-hmm. And Heiser is trying to get us back to that kind of understanding of the world, especially as we read the Old Testament. We read through those eyes. So, once again, back to the question, finally. We have a guy who's – a questioner is asking, was that blind faith? And it wasn't blind faith. There were reasons why he was convinced that God, a God – you know, at that point, was communicating to him. I don't know if he was, at that point, he was a diehard monotheist. These things developed a little bit in the minds of the people then, at least in light of the culture at the time. There's very good evidence that the first, most primitive beliefs about God were monotheistic, and then they developed into polytheism, and partly because there was a lot of other gods, Elohim, in the Old Testament, divine figures that exist and are making an impact in the world and have an influence on the cultures. And so, the God of Abraham, you know, made himself known to Abraham and made a promise and said, "You follow me, and I will bless you." Another thing, by the way, just a postscript on that particular set of circumstances. It's amazing to me how frequently that band of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob folk, not Abraham, but his subsequent kids, were complicit with idols, idolatry. Because when Jacob says, okay, we're going to get out and we're going to gather all our stuff and we're going to go see Esau, you know, he said, and by the way, gather up all your little idols, all your household idols. You know, and then when Jacob's left Laban, his wife, Rachel, stole Laban's idols. And there was a big confrontation about that. And why was she stealing? Because in her mind, they had power. You know, and so she was stealing. And Laban was upset because now his power objects were gone. So there's a lot of screwy things going on there.
Yeah, obviously Abraham didn't have what we have. We can look back over all of history and see what God has done. So obviously we have a lot more evidence about who God is, just in terms of what we've seen him do. But also, if God is revealing himself to Abraham, he's revealing as much of himself to Abraham as Abraham needs to know that he's real and that he's trustworthy.
Yeah.
So I agree. I think that obviously that a direct appearance to Abraham is not blind. Obviously, he has reason. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go on to a question from Rolf Anderson. When elections are approaching, the following meme often appears on social media. If your church is telling you how to vote, then your church should be paying taxes. Or churches should pay taxes if they demonstrate for public policies. How would you address these?
Okay, I want to think this through a little bit, and I'm not... The reason that churches don't pay taxes is not because they don't talk about politics. If that were the case, there'd be a whole bunch of people that would take advantage of that. All right, I won't talk about politics if I don't have to pay taxes, okay? That's not the reason that they don't pay taxes. They don't pay taxes because they're a nonprofit organization. And there are all kinds of nonprofit organizations that don't pay taxes, okay? The idea that nonprofit organizations have their tax status threatened is a new idea. It's in my own lifetime. And it happened in the 1950s. And it was a bill passed under the direction of LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who later became president after John Kennedy was killed, and was a major promoter of the Vietnam War and the major promoter of a thing called the Great Society, which has caused utter chaos largely among black culture right now. And he was getting opposition from churches in the 50s. And so he got a law passed that said, if you're a church, you can't speak about politics, or else you will lose your 501c3 status and we'll start taxing you. Well, it's utterly illicit. It was a power move based on sectarian politics. And so, and I actually don't know how it could have survived constitutional muster, but no one's challenged it. But there's been a lot of talk of late to change that. Before that, churches could speak anything that how is it that you lose your constitutional right to speak about matters of any kind, particularly political matters, just because you get a tax break of some sort? Tax breaks are not meant to silence you. they can't be used to that because it's a violation of the First Amendment.
And no one's prohibited from talking about policies, right? It's just endorsing a candidate.
Well, that's true. And this particular – the way this is – so we can – but this is where it becomes a little tricky. And you know, about – trying to think, about 7 or 8 years ago now, we ran into a lot of trouble with the IRS because – around election time, I was talking about abortion, and the incumbent president there, Obama, had a very, very aggressive anti-life record. In fact, what he did was he vetoed or voted against – I shouldn't say veto because he was a senator in the state of Illinois at the time – twice voted against the Baby Born Alive Act. He was so pro-abortion that he thought abortion, the right to abortion, gives you a right to a dead baby, not to a procedure. And so if the procedure fails and the baby survives, you can still kill the baby ex utero after the baby's born. And this happens now. And so the bill was there was a bill on the table to make that explicitly illegal, and he voted against it. So this was the topic of a lot of conversation. But because I was speaking about a current moral issue that had policy ramifications, and one of the persons running for president stood behind that policy I was taking exception with, then this became a de facto attack on the current candidate and support for the opposing candidate, which is not legal according to this injunction. And so so you can see now, I mean, for people talk about a chilling effect on free speech, you know, this was one of them. And so we were put through all kinds of misery, Melinda and the team, because we had to transcribe all kinds of – one person complained, and the IRS went after us. Now, they didn't fine us after the dust settled, but they slapped our hands, said, don't do that again. And then Melinda said, we are not getting anywhere close to anything that sounds like this. So now, you know, that made it really difficult for us to do our job and to address the kinds of policy issues that needed to be addressed, particularly around election time that might be construed as being in support of one candidate or against another. That law is illicit. So nobody should be charged, should lose government benefits, for goodness sake, because they weigh in publicly. Think of all of the benefits the government gives all kinds of people. And incidentally, here's the benefit. They don't take the money that's yours. That's the benefit. Okay, we won't take money that's yours. They're not going out of their way to do us a favor. They're just saying we won't take as much money from you as we might of your money. So there's no relationship here. This is a misguided complaint, because this would mean that nobody who has a 501c3 could make any statement at all about politics that might be construed as sectarian, because then they can be disqualified from the benefits that they receive for a different reason. They're meant to be encouraged because they're helping the public good as a nonprofit organization.
And of course, I would assume that the people who are making this complaint are on a certain side, and there are people on their side who have 501c3s who also argue for positions. We're not paying taxes.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, are you kidding me? Or the Reverend Al Sharpton? Come on, you know, there are all kinds of churches that are campaigning on the left side of the political spectrum and nobody touches them. We got spanked during a time when the Obama administration was using the IRS to spank a lot of conservative groups.
And one thing I want to add to...
Another dereliction of duty, by the way, during that administration.
Tell us how you really feel, Craig.
Yeah.
We're not paying taxes for free speech. That's not what our taxes are for. So they should have no bearing on what we say.
That's right.
And it's also important to point out the reason why churches are tax exempt is because they didn't want the government controlling the churches with the taxes. It's because of the First Amendment. It's because of freedom of religion. By not having the government charge taxes to a church, you're removing the control that the government has over the church. So that's where it comes from. But that has nothing to do with Christians speaking out about what they think is true about any sort of topic. So I think what this really comes down to is people just don't want Christians speaking out because they disagree with them.
That's right.
And so that's their problem. But they often will even usually, because usually it's not churches who are going out and doing these things. I've never been at a church that had political messages. I've never attended a church that was like that. I'm sure there are some out there, and that's wrong for other reasons. But I think they just don't want Christians at all speaking about these issues, because Christians have a worldview that's antithetical to a lot of the culture right now. Mm-hmm. And the other problem is that Christians don't tend to change their minds, because we don't think our views are based on something that we can change. We think our views are based on what we know about what God has said about reality. And so because we're not changing our minds, and because we're not swayed by certain tactics of coercion or pressure, that really drives people crazy. And that is actually what has driven people crazy for centuries. Mm-hmm. When Christians are persecuted, it's because they refuse to bend the knee to whatever the culture is demanding they bend their knee to. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting that there was a video not too long ago about a mob that was going around to restaurants and demanding that they give this political sign, And it was for Black Lives Matter. And everyone agreed except for one person. And someone got right in her face and was screaming, "Are you a Christian? Are you a Christian?" Because she refused to.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know about that detail.
Yeah. So as it turns out, I don't think she was a Christian. But what's interesting to me is they assumed that the reason why she was not giving in to pressure was because she was a Christian.
Interesting. Wow.
And
that's very cool. Yeah. That is very cool. Turns out she was actually sympathetic towards the political issues that were being promoted there, but she didn't want anybody in her face bullying
her.
Right. And this is the biggest bullying crowd. The anti-bullying crowd bullies more than anybody else.
But isn't that just interesting that she would assume that? And that is infuriating to people because Christians do not budge from what they think is true.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think that's a lot of what's behind this. Everyone in this country should be free to give their opinion, regardless of what their background is.
Right.
And that includes people who are religious. And this idea that if you're religious, you suddenly have to be out of the political discourse is frankly crazy. Like, why are you suddenly not a citizen because you have you're coming from a religious perspective?
Of course, of course. So then only atheists and secularists can express their views. And when are you going to start saying, no, Christians can't vote? You know, we can't have our voice heard through our vote. And keep in mind that the American Revolution was fomented, developed, and all that stuff in the churches. This was the place where the community gathered to talk about these things. And that was true all the way until the mid-50s, when a politician, for personal reasons, decided to pass a law to silence one segment of the population, the Christian one, under threat of financial harm. And that's just wrong. I don't care what side of the spectrum you are on in terms of political policy, that ought to be considered wrong by everybody.
So if you go back on our website, I think it was back in August, Greg, you talked a couple of times about politics and, you know, should Christians stay out of politics? So I encourage everyone to go take a look at that, because Greg goes into this a lot more. I think there were a couple times in August.
Yes, and there was a piece I was referring to that is probably still on our website called No Hint of Politics. It was a piece I wrote that we used in, I think, Solid Ground or something. And that is what I heard a Christian educator say. There should be no hint of politics in anything we do. And it was just a patently ridiculous statement, though I think it was well-intentioned. And then I gave the particular reasons why that was really, really bad advice. And one of them is, just very quickly, is that if you say that we're not going to be in politics, all the other side has to do is to label some area as political. And then we have to wave the white flag. And then we're utterly irrelevant to things that are happening in daily life. And it turns out now that was prescient, because everything is political now. Family relationships, gender, sex, marriage, all of that. I mean, just for example, these are all things that were part of the so-called private sector. And now they're all political. Everything has been politicized. But this is characteristic of the left, who is taking over.
And just to clarify, lest anyone misunderstand, I would not go to a church that the pastor gave a political message every single week. I that's not what I would ever want. I mean, I think pastors should, as they're preaching sermons, should focus on the Bible. However, there are ideas in the Bible, because Christianity is a worldview, that address things that are going on. And so those are the things that are going to come up and that Christians are going to talk about. And especially Christians will be applying these things to things in the culture, even if it's not in a sermon or, you know, whatever. I think there are fewer, I'm sure there are churches that give political sermons. I've never seen one. Again, I'm not calling for that. So anyway, just in case somebody misunderstands, what, hopefully they know me well enough mm-hmm. and my love for the Bible and theology and everything to know what I expect to see in a church.
Well, so. as a worldview, as you pointed out, Christianity has the truth of the nature of the world reflected in Christianity has ramifications for policy considerations. This is why Christians campaigned vigorously in the United States and in Great Britain against slavery. And I'm wondering if these people that are objecting, if how they would feel if Christians were campaigning against slavery or any other thing that they thought was an injustice in our society or racism for now, which is the kind of hot button issue. And no, they'd be fine with that. And it's good that they campaigned against slavery because it was Christians largely and through the government and through the church that ended slavery. Within their political spheres. And that's a good thing. And had they not been vocal, it would not have changed, at least not for a long, long time.
And you know what's interesting, Greg, and I just tried to look it up, but I couldn't find it quickly enough. People actually did say at the time that it was religion intruding on politics and they should be quiet because they should keep religion private. They literally said that during the time when they were arguing against slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So this is nothing new, and it's nothing surprising.
Yeah.
All right, Greg. Well, thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for your questions. Send us those questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.